This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu here in Studio 2 because it's that Monday. Welcome back, Mayor.
Nice to see you.
So lots to talk about today. It feels like the news is just sort of rolling at this incredible speed. It might feel a little different, our conversation today, because there's so many things I need to hit with you, but I'll sort of give us signposts along the way. I'm looking forward to your thoughts on a lot of things. Right off the top, let's start with some news that actually hasn't quite happened yet. I understand that after you leave here, you're going to a press conference.
We're making more news.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. Let's start there.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about street safety. If you are in any part of the city, you likely are used to dodging cars going all too fast, not only on the major arterials, but even on residential side streets, as more of the mapping apps and Waze and everything has made it so that all streets are kind of on the table for people to be zooming down. So the city previously had an approach where it was very concentrated, very intense in only a small number of areas. And there was even an application program with many, many neighborhoods on the waiting list for street improvements like speed humps or flashing signals or an intersection redesign. We are now taking a much broader approach. We don't want to be chasing these incidents and injuries anymore. We want to get ahead of them.
So I'm imagining this is a rollout of traffic calming measures across a wide swath of the city, and you'll be announcing sort of that plan. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's a major shift in approach where, again, it's much more citywide, tactical, more agile and faster. Our goal is to dramatically increase the number of intersections and parts of the city that we are touching with these improvements. There's funding in the budget that is under review by the city council right now for this to be implemented over the next year. And we're also coordinating not just the physical changes to the streets, but also signalization, because that is also, you know, whether pedestrians have the signal for how long, how our streetlights are fitting together, that has a big role to play as well.
And one last question on this. Was this always part of the plan, or was there some tipping point that made you decide to do this way and now?
I have been, even on the council, very frustrated. You know, I have two young children, and you hear far too many stories of families who are now forever changed because of something completely outside of their control. And every time you cross the street with little kids, I find myself gripping them really tightly. That's always on your mind. And I hear from far too many residents who say their kids can no longer play in their front yards because there have been incident after incident of cars moving so fast that they even come up over the curb. And we've had fatalities in just recent weeks of people sitting on their porch hit by a speeding vehicle. So it's time to take a different approach. We cannot have safety as a mechanism that gets rationed across neighborhoods according to the most dire of situations. This has to be a baseline for everyone.
All right. So we'll look for that at your press conference this afternoon. Now we're going to take a bath in the news of the day now, and I'm going to start with redistricting. City of Boston, where the clock is ticking after a judge, just for listeners who may not be up to speed on this, a judge found that the map that was passed by the Boston City Councilors last fall likely wouldn't withstand a legal challenge if a challenge says race was too heavily considered in how the lines were drawn. So it comes back to the city. And just, of course, redistricting happens every 10 years based on census data. So you have said you need to sign a new map by May 30th for elections to happen on time. You submitted a new proposal. There were three other proposals put on the table last week. So then last Friday, there's a city council meeting. Boston City Councilor Ruth Z. Louis-Jean, who chairs the committee in charge, made it clear her version was going to be the working version, not the final version, but a working version. Changes would be made based on that. So I've got a series of sort of short pointed questions for you on that. First, is there anything currently in that version, that working version, that is a non-starter for you? So if something in that version comes to you for signature, it's dead on arrival, you can't sign it.
Well, things are happening so fast that I would say each of the versions had different elements that are already being incorporated into the council's current working version anyway. So if we're judging off of where the council left off Friday, for example, I'm not at the point yet. One, they're still moving. I think there's another session later this afternoon even. And so Wednesday will be the date where they would likely, hopefully, take a vote so that we can review and then have some time before the deadline in order to potentially suggest amendments. My concern is going to be thinking about places where neighborhoods are, I believe neighborhoods are the most important unit of cohesion and organizing and civic life in Boston. And there are places in the map where some neighborhoods are split up way more than other neighborhoods are. And so I'm looking to see if there are precincts here or there that can just help unify and add more cohesion to each community's voice.
Are there any neighborhoods that you need to see unified that weren't before? You're saying, you know, neighborhood X or this affordable housing complex or public housing complex has to be intact or I'm not okay with it.
Yeah, there are a number of, again, moving pieces. The map that I proposed was put together with the starting point that we had to address what the court highlighted in terms of communities that needed to be reunited because of that legal decision, and then communities that traditionally have been split up, like Fields Corner or Upham's Corner or the Bowdoin-Geneva area or parts of Mission Hill. And so that was a general principle. This is about math and getting to equal representation within districts. So there's always ripple effects but from moving things around, and it's not perfect. But according to the principles that need to be applied around compact districts and following the traditional principles and having communities of interest together, I think they're headed in the right direction. So I'm hopeful and looking forward to following how it goes later today as well.
And have you been explicit with members of the Boston City Council about what your needs are so that they get something to you that you will sign?
The goal of putting out my version, which was never anticipated to be the be-all, end-all or a perfect map, no perfect map exists, was to just prod the conversation along so that people have concrete things to react to. I think they are now firmly in the stage of going line, you know, precinct by precinct, talking among colleagues, making these changes, moving things around. So we're finally starting to see movement with a broader conversation than just an individual silo.
So I'm so sorry. I literally can't tell if you're telling me that there are deal breakers for you or not.
Deal breakers would include violations of the Voting Rights Act. Deal breakers would include an interpretation that we are actually not following the legal decision and the consequences that the judge has laid out, and areas where specific neighborhoods might be unnecessarily split up. But it's hard to tell right now because I could say I want X, Y, or Z neighborhood to be united, but once you look at the map, that it's just mathematically impossible. So it's hard to be very clear about everything is just spills over into the next district.
And how hard is May 30th? Let's say there's a back and forth and an extra 24 hours would make all the difference. A June 1st would actually make a difference. If it spills over into June 1st, does that necessarily push the September election dates, or is there any wiggle room on that back end?
So just a step back on why the deadlines matter and where we even are in the overall process that's causing quite a lot of stress already. Every time the census data comes back, the state goes first, and the state usually at the state government level, they set congressional and state legislative districts because they are on the even year right after the census data comes back. Usually that's, you know, for example, in 2020 was the census, 2021 the data comes back, 2022 is the first state legislative cycle, election cycle that their districts were applied, 2023 is the first municipal cycle following the census. The rules are that a candidate must live in a district for a full year until counting backwards from the election day for them to be qualified to run in that district. Now, that is why we strive to finish those lines by November at the very latest of 2022, because then by November 23, when the elections happen, potential candidates would know if they were able to run. They could theoretically move to a different area, slide over a precinct if they needed to, if they were determined to run. We are now well past that deadline.
Because that map is the one that went to the court.
Exactly.
And so that's
already out the window. And we have people across the city who some have announced their districts might change now since they've announced. Some are thinking about it potentially, and we're now well past that. Now we're talking about May 30th being the date that is really crunch time for letting candidates now assess their new lines, have a period to collect signatures, get those signatures certified and validated, and then print up ballots and have those go out. If we push much past this deadline, we will be making a trade-off and probably having to give up in-person early voting and no longer have to, because that happens usually a little about 10 days before election day. There are locations open across the city in the neighborhoods where anyone can vote early at any of those, not just where you live, near where you live. And so that takes extra coordination. We're already pushing up against that.
So a really clear sense then of what the trade-off of not hitting this deadline
That's is. Right. And state law, the minimum now is only that you must hold the election, you know, in a fair and a robust way, and also provide mail-in voting, which can happen concurrently. State law allows municipalities who want to do early in-person voting to do that, but it doesn't require it. So we wouldn't be necessarily, we wouldn't be breaking the law, but we like to offer the fullest version of access to the ballot.
All right, so I want to stay with the Boston City Council. I know you're not surprised by what's going to come next, because we've been watching what's been unfolding with the two federal ethics reports about former U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins, who resigned on Friday. She had announced earlier in the week that she would be submitting her resignation by Friday. And in the revelations in those two reports, which allege that she violated a set of federal ethics laws, one of the things that came up was her involvement in the Suffolk County DA race last year. Boston City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo ran in that race. One of the reports referred to Rollins as essentially being a de facto campaign advisor to Arroyo. There's much more in that. I'll refer listeners to extensive coverage we did at RadioBoston.org for more detail there. You've been asked about calls for Arroyo to resign. You told more than one television station in the last few days, listen, there's an election in a matter of about 5 months. This is a ballot issue. This is where the voters decide. I want to understand this clearly, because it feels like that time factor is essential to your answer. If we were not close to an election, all other things being the same, but election is a year away, would that change your feeling on whether or not Boston City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo would need to resign his post?
No. Fundamentally, what I'm trying to communicate is that there are high standards for conduct for public officials. We act on behalf of many, many residents who are not in those spaces with us, may not be in rooms where conversations are taking place and decisions are being made. And in every possible way, those who are enforcing the law in particular cannot be above the law. And I think that's what the ethics investigation and subsequent resignation at the federal level has shown. Now, when it's an elected official, the city council, for example, has had moments in history where there have been back and forth about whether certain allegations or even legal ramifications should result in someone being expelled from the body or stepping down. And in those situations, legally, it was determined that elected officials are subject, most of all, to accountability by the public. Of course, if there's clear behavior that has been, legally identified or criminally decided or shown to be crossing that line into illegal behavior, that is a different matter. In the spaces where there is gray area, frankly, where a behavior might be inappropriate or unethical but not illegal, that there's not much wiggle room in terms of the ability for, the authority for people to override, for government structures to override the will of the people. So that bond between people being elected and able to choose their representatives is very, very important.
So you're making it really clear that in answer to that question, that that's the lever you believe is the right lever here. I want to bring a listener voice in. You know that we reach out via our texting group. We give listeners an opportunity to text in questions. If you want to join that group, you text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. Anthony of Dorchester texted, "Why hasn't Mayor Wu condemned the actions of Ricardo Arroyo? Why hasn't she asked for his resignation? Why won't she listen to the voters demanding his resignation? Why doesn't she urge the city council to formally establish recall procedures in the city of Boston?" I feel like you've addressed a good chunk of that. The recall question is a little bit different, and since it comes from a resident of Dorchester, I want to give you a chance to address that piece of it.
I think we are, again, this is in this particular case, you know, I think there's a philosophical conversation overall about whether recall as a mechanism should be added to, you know, changing a form of government. And there are places and jurisdictions across the country where this has been exercised to a lot of attention and high profile news coverage. We are in a system where city council, for example, is a 2-year election cycle. I know as someone who served on that body that it is a pretty rapid turnaround every 2 years. And I actually had voted against proposals to extend that term to 4 years because I believed that having greater accountability in that way was productive and actually helpful to be able to show movement and to be able to have that frequent iteration and interaction with voters and accountability on the ballot. To, you know, again, this is a wider question. I'm not saying this as someone who has any authority over being able to sign a paper and make these changes, but as an individual and as someone who's been in different parts of the system, having the ability to find that balance between accountability and voters having the mechanism to express their preferences and stability and being able to get work done and not constantly be caught up in back and forths. You know, we're already in an era where lawsuits are being used very frequently as, you know, sometimes with little odds of success as a way to just kind of keep things a little bit unsettled. And we, you know, the number of lawsuits that the city now has to experience and put resources to is far higher than ever before. And I think this is true for cities across the country because there's now a more established model of when people disagree with the democratic process, there are many efforts to try to undermine or sow suspicion. And again, we have to be meeting the highest standards for accountability to the voters. That can look very different ways. But most of all, I think, you know, the ballot for elected officials is that number one source of accountability.
And we're going to move on from this, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, but I'm also going to note, I'm pushing you on this because of statements. However, only one Boston City Councilor has called for the resignation of Boston City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo. There is more that will unfold here. I'm not sounding a particular drumbeat following, and I want to acknowledge that here on air because we've spent a chunk of time on this here, and it's in that context that we were doing so. I do, before we go to break, I want to ask you one other question. Some eyebrows went up when your WCVB On the Record interview aired yesterday because you expressed some optimism that you were close to securing the necessary permits to rebuild the Long Island Bridge to Quincy, and then later Tom Koch, the mayor of Quincy, pushed back saying that he didn't think the permitting was as close as you did, according to the Boston Globe. So what specifically has changed to make you say you think you're close to having that, the necessary permits?
You know, close is a relative term. We have been in the permitting process for 5+ years at this point as a city. Our administration has stepped into it, inheriting it from 2 prior administrations who were working on this. We are down to an environmental permit from the state and a U.S. Coast Guard permit for the for a potential bridge. Each of these has required different bits of information and a little bit of back and forth. We have submitted everything that has been asked for and have a sense that review is moving forward. And so from our eyes, we've now reached the point where we've obtained a number of permits already. Litigation has been resolved in a major way, and we're now down to the final parts of review for these two.
And should you receive authorization on those 2 permits, do you require any further cooperation from Quincy in order to build the bridge? And money aside, et cetera, do you require further cooperation from Quincy to build the bridge?
You know, legally, I think once the permits are there, the city of Boston has the authority to do what the city needs to do. But from a just neighborly and you know, respect for the mayor and for the residents who are very much in the same ecosystem as us, experiencing the same challenges around the opiate crisis and housing affordability and everything else that we're working on. The mayor and I have sat down previously, and I don't find Quincy to be opposed to the need for recovery services, and in fact, the mayor has been very supportive of ways that we could work together. I think they rightly and fairly want to understand what the impact would be for their residents in terms of the uses that will eventually be located on the island. What would that mean for vehicular traffic or the construction process? And those are all conversations that we not only should collaborate on from just a way of advancing, you know, our shared interests, but it will be better and we'll have a more effective program if we see this as a regional recovery campus and not just one for Boston, because this issue in and of itself is a statewide national issue. We are receiving residents, individuals seeking services from all over the Commonwealth, beyond the Commonwealth, and Boston is trying our best to step up and do whatever we can, but we need this to be a collaborative effort.
You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm host Tiziana Deering, and we are picking back up with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu right here in Studio 2 and our Monday with the mayor. And I want to talk about housing. You have 75 Boston families who have been able to buy homes, 71% residents of color. About $2 million of American Rescue Plan Act money has gone into helping them with either down payments or closing costs or interest relief for affordable purchases. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, considering the scale of what we need to do and how many of Boston's renters are rent burdened and struggling, this might seem like something that's very small, but the process of buying a home can be quite extensive. I think anyone who's gone through it, there's the whole search process, getting all the documents together, proving this and that, assembling the down payment. And so in just, you know, about a year since this program has been kicked off, to have 75 families going all the way through purchasing homes in 11 neighborhoods from West Roxbury in the South End to East Boston, Hyde Park, Jamaica Plain, it's really exciting to know that it works. And this is a model where if we can have continued resources, once these ARPA dollars, the federal recovery dollars, expire in 2025 into 2026, we need to be able to keep this momentum going. That's why we have some initiatives up at the state, for example, the transfer fee that would generate significant resources to continue this work. But we're trying to build pipelines to home ownership from every possible angle. This program, in partnership with many of our community partners, we also specifically are looking at ways to support Boston Housing Authority families who are living in subsidized housing to go not just to renting a market rate apartment, but to go directly from living in a BHA apartment to owning a home as well. We want people to be able to skip all those steps and go straight to stability.
Perfect. So let's go there. Before we do, I'm just going to note you made reference to the transfer fee. That's a home rule petition up at the State House. I want to come back to home rule petitions in a little bit, but we have another question from our texting group. And again, text Boston to 617-766-0382 to join that group so you can send questions to Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. Devin of Dorchester says, why the focus on home ownership when renters can't even stay in the city? And, you know, that, I think that follows on to what you just said. So pick up on Devin's question.
The best way to get in total control of your rent costs is to become your own landlord, is to own your home and build up equity and start saving up that wealth to be able to pass down to the next generation. So we are, again, it's not just one silver bullet or one way that we're working. We are certainly creating more affordable home rental units than ever before. Last year, the city permitted more affordable housing than in 25 years. Many of those were rental units. We're looking to partner with organizations who are building new housing. We are putting funding into existing affordable housing that might either expire or need major renovations. Otherwise, they would be unlivable, to preserve existing housing. This is really anything and everything. We are moving forward with all hands on deck approach to housing.
Of course, an article in the Boston Globe over the weekend raising concerns that that actual building of permitted units could slow down, both with what's happening in the market and with plans around the Boston Planning and Development Authority, another home rule petition, and again, I'm going to put a pin in the home rule petition part because I want to talk about that separately. And then we have the question of the federal funding. You just noted, right? The 75 Boston families were funded by ARPA money, American Rescue Plan Act money. That runs out in a couple of years. You've got another initiative with 17 different sites that could produce up to 800 affordable housing units. A chunk of that is also COVID money. So take head on the chunk of this that comes from money that will go away when the building won't be done yet, and the concern that there's a gap between having the money, having the permits, and getting the units and getting people in them.
Yeah, and I think it's important to also clarify some of what these numbers mean, because that, you know, it's been highlighted in a number of different places how last year the total number of approved housing units was the lowest since 2015, I believe. If you extrapolate this and look at the data nationally, the changes in interest rates, the difficult economic environment that we are in is a national situation. And there are, you know, in to varying degrees, but this is something that people, builders, are experiencing way beyond Boston. And that is driving most of what we see in a little bit of a tightening of the market. I will also say that in the last few years, there were many, many years-long approvals processes that wrapped up that in some ways were a little bit of outliers in those numbers. The Suffolk Downs project, which is, you know, by the 20 years from now, hopefully will be some 30,000 housing units. Tens of thousands of housing units, I'll say, depending on how it ends up getting permitted the rest of the way. That was approved in one big chunk after a many-year process. A similar project in Charlestown around redeveloping the subsidized housing there with mixed units on top, a very, very large-scale project. Those were a little bit driving the numbers a different direction than we otherwise would have seen. We have 22,000 approved units in the pipeline that are not yet in construction. And so Boston has a very healthy pipeline. There's another 10,000 units that are currently under review by the BPDA. This year, we're not even halfway through the year, and we are already at almost equal to the total number of units that were approved for all of 2022. So we're making good strides. We're doing outreach in every way possible, trying to change the incentives, speeding up our processes, changing the zoning code to make things more predictable so that we can not only approve more units, but most importantly, get from approvals into actually permitted construction. We're trying to just make it possible for these projects to get into the ground.
Now, I do not want to spend a lot of time on this next question, but I do want to briefly ask it, because much is being made in some articles about a chilly relationship between you and business and you and real estate. And that can affect getting from permitted to built. So do you agree that you have a chilly relationship, especially with commercial and residential real estate developers?
I think we share the same goals of wanting the permitting process and development to be thriving, growing, and as predictable as possible. I think it's also kind of funny sometimes that there's this, you know, no community is a monolith. People can say this about any ethnic group or any sort of policy interest group. There is no such thing as just the business community overall, or, you know, real estate, capital R and E in the city. I have, you know, relationships and enjoy advice from and learn a great deal from many people within this industry. I know many of them very, very well. Are there still some individuals who might be worried or are, you know, talking to the media in different ways? That will be true in any situation. But I think our chief of planning in the BPDA, Arthur Jemison, is fantastic. We couldn't have better leadership at the helm there. We're making real strides in large projects being approved that not only are going to deliver the units, but also bring a new approach to how we are collaborating with community and therefore delivering even more benefit beyond just a sort of number count. This is going to be about the health and well-being and opportunity for our communities. I think we are doing we're making a lot of progress on this front, and you know, the numbers will speak for themselves. But this is a change that I frankly, for a long time, have been clear that I don't believe that one single person, the mayor, should be personally involved in every bit of construction and development across the city? Do I sign off on the policies that the BPDA is implementing? Do I get updated every single week, often multiple times a week, on the projects that are happening and the choices that we're making? Absolutely. But we don't need a bottleneck, and we need an approach that is much more consistent and clear across the board.
And you're trying to change that, which now takes me to the home rule petitions, because you've got three up at Beacon Hill that it seems to me are linchpins. Can you have three linchpins? Today we're going to pretend you can have three linchpins of your housing strategy. You have one on what you call rent stabilization, commonly referred to as rent control. You have one on this restructuring of the Boston Planning and Development. And you have one on transfer fees, which is on real estate transactions over $2 million. One, we'll do this rapid fire. Do all three have to pass these home rule petitions for you to be able to get the bulk of your housing strategy done? Do they or don't they?
I mean, all three are very important. There are different ways to achieve what we're trying to do besides just home rules as well. For example, with rent stabilization, there could be either a home rule petition for Boston, or there could be enabling legislation that affects the whole state, or there could be a ballot initiative that changes it down the line. With the BPDA...
No, I'm going to stop you there, because you made that reference to the ballot initiative when we talked about this in March, too. So let me not fail to ask you a second time. Do you have plans for a ballot initiative, and would you support one if the home rule petition on rent stabilization doesn't pass?
It depends what the language looks like. I know that this is an issue that many, many care about across the Commonwealth, not just Boston. And so if the ballot initiative would be such that Boston has room to implement what we've put forward as our proposal, absolutely, I would support that. If the ballot initiative ends up being very specific and then actually not aligned with what Boston is doing, that would be a different story, which is why we wanted to put forward our proposal to begin with. And, you know, I think it's I was just at a neighborhood coffee hour down the street, our parks hour, where department heads are out in community. And someone who was a landlord who lives in the community, owns several properties, was very worried about rent stabilization, came up and just wanted to advocate against the idea. And I asked her, are you raising your rents by more than 10% a year? And she said, absolutely not. But I'm worried about once this happens, could there be some other loophole that then changes it, and then you know, we won't actually have the proposal that you put forward?
So because your proposal caps it at a maximum of 10%,
which is about addressing the price gouging that's happening to far too many. There were also tenants at that coffee hour who shared that their tenants within a large conglomerate who owns many, many units across the city, and they're not from here, and they keep raising their rents by way more than 10%. And so there are two situations here that I think sometimes all get bundled together. We wanted to be very specific about what Boston needs, which is a proposal that will enable us to keep growing our economy, building new housing, not discouraging any of that, while putting those protections in place. I think there's sometimes misinformation about who would actually be impacted. And the vast majority of the good landlords in Boston who are doing what they can to keep their tenants in place and support their own businesses, this is not about them. This is about protecting those who need it most. And there's a growing number in that category as well. But in terms of the legislation, there are numerous ways to get there. We're not going to give up on how to make housing more affordable every possible way that we can. We're not going to give up on planning being connected to the needs of community. And we need to find sustainable revenue sources to keep this going even after our federal funds dry up.
So these are just the first way.
Yes.
You ready to talk about summer?
Oh, absolutely. It's a little chilly today, but we had a beautiful last couple of days.
Yeah. Well, did you do anything fun over the weekend?
There were many, many things. There was a Haitian Flag Day parade, followed by Polish Fest, a summit, our Amplified GSA summit, and lots of activities.
Did you get any good snacks? It sounds like there'd be a lot of wonderful food at those events. Any delicious snacks that stand out from the
weekend? We always squirrel away a little bit into the car afterwards, yeah.
I would eat snacks through that whole thing if I did that. All right. So listen, I want to talk about a couple of things. Last time you were here, you talked about a really ambitious summer jobs program, giving lots and lots of youth summer jobs. We actually had on Action for Boston Community Development, ABCD, since then, who are placing 1,500 youth in summer jobs. They brought a young man along with him, Juan Echevarria Ruiz, who has worked in the Summer Works program for a couple of years, will again this summer. And he talked a little bit about the impact on summer jobs for him.
I'm taking a certificate of early childhood education because that camp opened my mind of little kids and teenagers as well. So now I'm working in an internship with kindergartners and pre-kindergartners.
Headed off to community college, knows what he wants to do now, which felt to me like kind of coming full circle with the case you made. So how are we doing in getting those jobs filled, getting youth into, I think, the 7,000 that you were hoping to do this summer?
Yeah, it's been really exciting. And thanks so much to all of our community partners. ABCD is our biggest partner, but we slightly restructured the program this year as well to better empower and take away some of the hoops and bureaucracy that many of the young people had to jump through. The city's process is now going directly to our sponsor organizations and companies out in the community. So I don't have the most updated count, but we know that the recruitment is, we're still trying to place people in their spots. And there was a lot of interest, a lot of outreach, job fairs. We held a job fair, I think it was at Reggie Lewis a couple weekends ago, that was absolutely packed. So our young people are eager to find and work hard at every opportunity. We just have to make them available and accessible.
And a note for listeners, paying jobs. These are paying jobs.
Absolutely.
For young people. All right. So in our texting group, Claire of Dorchester wrote, not a question, but a thank you. Last year, I texted asking about more open street days, and I'm really excited that they're back this summer. Anything you want to add about what you're doing with open streets this year?
Yes. We had three to just see how it would go last year, and now we're expanding to five. So it will be, I hope I can get all these, Jamaica Plain, Roxbury, Alston, Brighton, East Boston, and Dorchester, Dot Ave, Dorchester, and as well as Open Newbury being available on the weekends for double the number of weekends that it was last summer. It will basically be continuously throughout the summer and supporting different community groups who are hosting their festivals and street parties by simplifying the permitting process and having more staff to walk folks through and make that easier.
So that's the other thing. In addition to supporting the community groups that way, I do want to talk about these summer activation mini grants. We've had an opportunity here on the show to speak with Isaac Yablo, who's the city's senior advisor for community safety. You've talked about jobs in context of community safety. You've talked about open streets and sort of helping people feel like they own their communities in the context of community safety. Now that we have these grants of up to a few thousand dollars that are, as I understand it, specifically designed to help local grassroots groups and community organizations do activities that put people physically in their community spaces with actually a safety angle in mind. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Not to get too dramatic about this, but I really believe that the first, easiest, fastest step you can take to save our democracy is to host a block party, because we are now in a moment where people are so busy, so attached to devices, working multiple jobs, that we don't know our neighbors as much as several generations ago. And that leads to all sorts of consequences in who you trust, how tightly knit the social fabric is, where you go when you need something as just a member in the community. And block parties are the most beautiful and joyful way to get to know people who might look differently from you, speak differently from you, worship different, vote differently from you, but share the same stake in a sense of place. And we want to make that as easy as possible. So we'll provide some funding for a number of events and groups. If you will get the flyer out and go have conversations with your neighbors to pick the date together, organize to find the location, you know, use the funding that can then go to hot dogs or popsicles or, you know, hula hoops for the kids. That's the first step in a lot of ways to what we see across many neighborhoods in Boston, longstanding neighborhood associations or community groups or just text chains or email lists of neighbors who are there for whatever their fellow community member might need. And that also then translates into safety with people being active and out in the street. It translates into opportunity for the young people who have a wider exposure to different careers and adults in their lives. It leads to more advocacy for what's needed. You can point out when we need to come in and fix a sidewalk or plant a tree or make improvements to that school community. The collective voice that can be amplified really starts with getting to know each other.
You know, a little more than a decade ago, I ran an organization that did work in Grove Hall, and we funded Black parties for this reason. And two of the things that we learned from that, one, that it was really important to older adults becoming reintroduced to feeling safe in their neighborhoods, wanting to be back out in community, knowing other families, feeling like they could own their sidewalks and streets again. And two, that actually it was a really important way for local law enforcement to also better know and build trust. And I'm curious about how Boston Police Department sees these Black parties. Do they come and participate? Is that an opportunity to build better relationships? And how do you think about that?
They haven't been directly involved in the Black parties. But, you know, and I think, you know, we are really wanting to make sure that this is first and foremost about neighbors coming together, whether it's tenant associations or neighborhood groups or just a group of concerned and active individuals on a street. BPD is a key part of our community building, and the bonds that they can have with small business owners, with community leaders and civic groups. Commissioner Cox has really been focused on community policing and getting information out. Previously, what's called CompStat, a review of all the statistics for public safety, happened internally only, and that's where strategy would be made, and we could see trends across the city. He's now taking that out into the community. And so on a monthly basis, each district hosts a community CompStat. You know, names are anonymized, and there's no, with some privacy considerations, but a review of what's happening so that people can plug in and get involved. It's a similar concept.
So I'm going to switch gears. We're here with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, and we have gone through a whirlwind of news issues. I keep saying whirlwind, a whirlwind, I can say it correctly, of news issues today. And one I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about is Boston Pride. Last week on Thursday, actually, we spoke with Thais Rocha, who's the co-founder of LGBTQ Nightlife Events, trying to open a lesbian bar, one of fewer than 30 in the entire country, trying to open it here in the city of Boston, hoping to open it by the end of the summer. She was actually on her way to your press conference about Boston Pride. So tell us a little bit about, I think it's the first gathering since 2019. The full Pride will
That's
be
right.
back. Very different after a series of controversies around inclusion of people of color, of trans members of our community. So briefly tell us what the plan is.
Yeah, I think most people will think about, when you say Pride, people think about the gigantic parade and party and festival that happens in June. That is back, and that's what had been, you know, for the pandemic and for some organizational changes that had not taken place in a while. So we're so excited that Pride for the People, a new group that has formed with a vow and mission to be fully inclusive in their efforts. They have been working very closely, not only with the city of Boston, but with the many, many advocacy organizations representing the LGBTQ community to get that event going. But what we were trying to make clear at the press conference and in so many of our efforts is that it's not just about one day and one event. First of all, there's a series of all sorts of gatherings and convenings and conversations that happen concentrated in the course of Pride Month in June. It kicked off this last weekend with Massachusetts Youth Pride, and so with a focus on young people that Bagley led, and the City of Boston's Amplify GSA Summit, which took place at the Boston Arts Academy.
Bagley's a local nonprofit organization, just for people to
know. Absolutely focused on young people. Yeah. And we want this to continue year-round, right? Similarly, as we're talking about the power of events to bring people together, this is about building the infrastructure and making sure that we have awareness and resources and collective action, because Boston, you know, sometimes people think of our city as one where everything's fine and we're pretty progressive and what's to worry about. There's always more to do, even here. There are important policies that are being proposed, and it's our obligation and responsibility to be even more clear about where we stand, given the national context of how many hateful laws and bills are being proposed.
So what about safety? I mean, the number of acts of intimidation around drag queen story hours alone raise that
including
question.
Here. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in our last 60 seconds or so, what about safety?
Yeah. We have very, very close partnerships. And so it's been an ongoing planning process. And we know that first and foremost, it is about community members feeling like they are fully involved and planning for the type of presence that is most conducive to everyone being their full selves in that moment. There might be considerations around, you know, privacy or photography or making sure that there are spaces set aside for different groups. We're working with organizers very closely and have had great partnerships from all city agencies in doing that.
All right, last question for you before we break. I've been thinking about the boys and their Celtics. Are they heartbroken? Are they watching? Are you watching with?
So,
how are you explaining to them?
These are important life lessons. And I still believe. Celtics in seven. But, you know, we didn't get to be a championship town by only being Fairweather fans. So we're in it. We're with them. We're going to keep going in this series.
And the boys are not too heartbroken yet.
No, they.
I know.
They're excited for every single basket.
And do you let them stay up and watch?
Unfortunately, that is yes.
Okay.
My guilt.
Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.